Welcome to Model Minority Moms, where we talk about the meaning of success in career, family, and life. We are Jeanette Park,
Kate Wong,
and Susan Liu,
Harvard classmates and Asian American working moms who get real about the pressures of fitting in while standing out.
Hello, hello, and welcome to Model Minority Moms. It's me, Kate. And no, Susan isn't sick or injured or dead. No. Today, Susan is on the receiving end of our lens as the subject of today's episode. As many of you know, Susan has been working on her memoir for the last couple years, and it's titled The Manicurist's Daughter, being published by Macmillan this March. Very excited. So here's what it says on the, you know, TLDR, an emotionally raw memoir about the crumbling of the American dream and a daughter of refugee who searches for answers after her mother dies during plastic surgery. So Jeanette and I have been lucky enough to read an advanced copy of the book, and we are really excited to discuss it with Susan today. Dun, dun, dun. Okay, Susan, I have so many questions. Jeanette has so many questions for you. But first, can you tell us a little bit about your journey to writing this memoir? Because I feel like a lot of people are like, yeah, I'd love to write a book, but you actually wrote one. So how did you get here?
Oh my God, how far back do you want me to go?
However you feel you want to talk about it. It's your day, your episode.
Sure. It starts in 10th grade. And that summer, I read Roots by Alex Haley. And I was like, oh my God, to actually know your family history or like this idea around multiple generations and how all these people impact each other. I was like, wow, that's so incredible. One day I'd like to actually write a memoir. And at the time, I guess I'm 15. I thought I would write it about my family, but I never thought I'd actually write it about my mother's death from a botched plastic surgery when I was 11. I never thought I'd actually write about the truth of our family. I just wanted to know our family origin story, but maybe it would stop at when my mom died. You know, like I never thought, hey, I'm going to write about our family tragedy. That was never the plan, everybody. That was never the plan.
Well, even though your mom passed when you were 11. So if you were thinking about this at 15, it had already happened. It had been a few years, but it was not really on your radar. Like as the
And this is the premise of why I wrote it. It was not on my radar because I've never been allowed to talk about it with my family. Mm-hmm. To this day, it's been 2 decades and we have never talked about my mother, her life, or how she died. So you can imagine the silence in our family when the matriarch of someone who owns the 2 nail salons, who helped sponsor over 8 of her family members from Vietnam to help power the nail salon. She was the one who really influenced us to become boat people to come to America. Like the matriarch is gone and we never talk about her ever again. And so actually when I was 15, I foolishly thought I wouldn't even talk about the death because I was just so not allowed to talk about the death. And fast forward to when I hit 30, I got married, got a lot of pressure to have kids. And I was just like, how can I have kids? How can I be a mother if I have never known her myself? And also in tandem, how can I be a mother when I know I am living in my own cowardice around me being a performer and being an artist? I've always wanted to do it. I started stand-up comedy in 2011. I was doing really well, actually, for about a year. And then I got heckled at a charity fundraiser. And after that, I was so traumatized by that. Like, wow, who was I kidding? Sure, I love doing that, but I suck. I'm bad at this. What a loser. You know, like, what a foolish idea. And so both my dream to be a performer and my desire to know the truth kind of converged in my early 30s. And I told Marvin, my husband, I'm not ready to become a mom until I kind of deal with my own stuff around this deep desire to be a performer. Give me 2 years. You do your mountaineering stuff. I'm going to do the performance stuff. Let me just get it out of my system because I know if I don't do that, I will project it onto my kid. I will force my kid to go to like drama school and all these things. And if they're not the best and if they're not the lead, why aren't they trying enough? You know, I knew that could easily be me because I didn't get to have it for me. So then that's when I started doing these solo shows. The fifth one turned into 140 pounds, How Beauty Killed My Mother. And to know my mother, I had to do research, right? Because my family wasn't ever going to talk about my mom. So I tracked down the plastic surgeon's family. I sought the help of spirit channelers. I went back to Vietnam several times and I read thousands of pages of depositions that my family and the doctor gave to piece together what happened on the day she died, to piece together who she was so that I could just finally know, right? Like, I just felt like there was this gaping hole in my heart and nothing was ever going to fill it. All the therapy didn't help. The awkwardness I had with my siblings and my dad asking, it just felt like there was something really wrong. And so I just had to do it. And every time I learned a new answer, I put it in the next one-woman show. The fifth one was 140 pounds. And when that happened, guys, also along the way, I got fired from my corporate job and decided I'm going to do this, take a big leap of faith. Like, maybe I should be an artist. Maybe this is going to work out. Even though at the time when I did that, I had only gotten a $500 grant and I had gotten like very hyper-local press. I wasn't sure that I should do this, but I pursued it for a year, turned into the show. It was a sold-out run and it was more than I could have ever imagined. And that's when I took out my IUD to have a kid. I got pregnant, which then I was thinking about a tour. Maybe I should take my show on tour. And right when I got pregnant, I knew in my second trimester, I should take this show on the road because this is my last chance dance. And so during my second trimester, I had a 10-city national tour. My book agent found me, asked me if I wanted representation, which like blew my mind. I actually thought it was a scam. When I got her email, I was like, oh my God, this is what I want. And I was like, ooh, maybe I should find other lit agents to see if I could get better. And I was like, I was so pregnant at the time. I was writing my next sequel called Over 140 Pounds. I was like, whatever, just say yes and see what happens. Had the baby March 2020, spent that whole year 2020 working on several drafts of a book proposal. Got my book deal in 2021 with Celadon Macmillan, which is their very nice imprint where they only release 20, 25 books a year. So I got the book deal March 2021, wrote for the next 2 years, fluttering about. I'll talk more about that. And then here we are. So it's like when you ask me, like, how did this all came about? Well, it came about because I knew that I could not move forward in this next chapter, not knowing like not just my mom, but am I allowed to have dreams? Am I allowed to pursue them? Am I actually even good at any of this? You know, am I allowed to have what I want in life? And so I started gunning for it. And I've been an artist for, I guess, now almost 6 years. And here we are.
Yeah, I just want to say, Susan, we're very proud of you. You know, I feel like that's not something we've talked about on the podcast before. Those types of words are not really like a thing in our families of origin. From reading your book, it seems definitely not a thing in your family. And my family either. But I just want to say, I'm really proud of you. I'm super proud of you. I think pursuing this thing that was important to you and then all the work that you put into making it a reality with your show and then now the book, I just want to give you like a big hug, right? And to say that as your friends, we are super proud of everything that you've done. So I just wanted to make sure that I said that on the record.
It's on the record, everybody.
And the other thing, too, I want everybody to know, because I feel like this is something that doesn't get revealed, because everybody thinks like a book somehow, this creative, mystical process where you sit with a cup of coffee by like a gurgling brook and you're like, inspiration, come to me, you know? No. So because we've seen Susan the last couple of years, right? So first of all, I'm going to just put it out there. This is what Susan told me, so I'm just going to say it. Susan said, and I quote, I don't really know how to write that well. And actually, Susan, tell you a really funny story about being an Xbox 10.
A what?
College. You don't remember X-Class 10?
Oh my God.
I feel like it's so telling. We need to really show everybody how hard you worked at this. I think it's very important.
Okay. Now that you've just revealed that I'm the dumb Harvard student.
No. That was not my intention. I just wanted to show how hard you worked.
No, you know, guys, even at business school, I also went to math camp. We all know I got a 1320, okay, on SATs. I wasn't a 1600, but my brother, when I was in seventh or eighth grade, he read one of my essays and he told me, hey, you're a really bad writer. And I was like, oh, okay. And I took that as truth. And then I always thought, oh, yeah, I'm just bad at this, you know? And I'm going to over-index on all these other things like community service. And when I applied to Harvard, I got in, I was super shocked. And they said, hey, you are allowed to come. I'm like, great. And then they're like, but you have to take Expos 10, expository writing.
Yeah.
And because everyone starts at 20. It's Expos 20 is for all the other people who like are really good at writing. But you need to take an extra semester with the jocks and really kind of fine tune your writing and your ability to write. So that you'll succeed and do well in college. And I said, fine, that's fine. And I thought it was incredibly hard class, actually. I find writing really intimidating and scary. And my honest truth is I love writing the introduction and I love writing the conclusion. And that's what I write first in anything. And then I dread the middle. I hate evidence. I hate explaining myself. I'm like, no, I just want to engage you in and then make you cry at the end. You know, I'm a performer. I'm an entertainer. I'm a storyteller, but I never thought I was a writer. And I got to tell you, once someone was introducing me at this like Asian American theater mixer, and someone was like, and this is Susan, a playwright. I almost spit my beer all over the table because I never thought I was writing something. It just seems like so loaded. And I was just like, that's not me. I'm not a writer. Yeah, I don't have an MFA. I have an MBA. I think this was all feels very accidental in a way. Yeah, I'll just leave it there.
Well, I'll just say that there's a lot of different kinds of writing, right? And there's a lot of different kinds of skills. And so I think that the type of writing that we're doing in XBOS is very academic. You know, I love Harvard. I am thankful for it and appreciate my time there deeply. But I also think not everything that Harvard values is, it's not the end all be all of what's important in the world anyway. So I think you did a great job.
And you learned the craft of writing a book. It's different to write a book versus if you're just, I consider myself a good writer, generally speaking, but I don't know how I would go about, even for someone who has confidence in their writing, I find the idea of a book very intimidating, which you think is funny because I've published books, but that was based on stuff that I wrote already. So it wasn't like going into this thing with not anything written. And so I don't know, Susan, I just feel really proud of you in that way, because I feel like, kind of piggybacking what Jeanette said earlier, you tackled something that was really hard for you and that's new for you.
Oh my God.
You know, I want people to know that, right? Like people, I feel like it's easy for people to, oh yeah, Susan, you know, went to Harvard, whatever. She's smart. So how hard could it have been writing a book? But we saw you. It was a struggle. You had to work really hard and you were really good at accepting feedback from your editor and other people. I really want that made explicit because I feel like that's not valued. Because most people assume, well, if you got a book deal, then you must already be like a good writer. How hard is it, you know? And you made all your deadlines, Susan. That's the other thing. Because when I think about you and I think about like George R.R. Martin, who's what, 15 years overdue on...
He said he's not going to do it.
He's not going to do it. But my point is, you know, we traditionally think of like writers as, oh, deadline, whatever. That's just optional, right? But you worked really hard to make your deadlines. Like you took everything so seriously.
I mean, look, what is a deadline? Okay, because my editor, Deb Futter, she edited Pachinko, she's the bomb. She was like, no wine before it's time, Susan. Because I'd be like, okay, when do you need this by? 3 months from now? She's like, no wine before it's time. Like, she wanted things to ferment. It was like when the time was right. And I was like, come on. You say I met all my deadlines, but I did and I didn't. I missed all my arbitrary deadlines, but the one deadline I did meet was my goal to publish while I was still 38 because my mom passed when she was 38. And that was my ultimate deadline. In a way, I think you can always kind of get more extensions from your editor to whatever. Like, it's kind of like when the book is ready, the book is ready. But for me, my deadline was to honor my mother. And I did meet that deadline. But as you have read in the preface, it came with a cost.
Yes, it's true. Your health fiasco last year. Yeah.
And I will say, okay, sure, I met the deadline. But you two saw when I was like emotionally a mess. Or like when the deadline was coming, I had canceled stuff with you or like I couldn't function. I mean, it was also memoir. I would have loved to have written a mystery space zombie thriller where like, sure, the characters are still just really my family members. But I wrote something that was my truth. And I had to continue to unravel things that I still didn't even really know about myself through the thing. So it's been a journey.
I was curious about that because, you know, I've watched all your shows before COVID. You know, I've known you for a while and we've dug into a lot of your past and your current self in the podcast, but the book, right? So what?
Wait. I know you're asking me, but I got to ask you a question. You read the book. How did it make you feel?
Oh, okay. Oh, I was saving that for later, but okay, I'll tell you now. Well, so it was interesting because I went into it again saying I felt like I already knew a lot about Susan. I was like, what's new? And this is where I feel like different mediums have different forms of power. I think the power of the theatrical, your live show, is that it brings this sort of your personal raw emotion to the surface. And the audience, it's very visceral, right? But it's you doing the storytelling. You're saying the words, even if it's my mom said this or my brother said this, but it's coming out of Susan Leo's mouth with Susan Leo's inflection because you're live. I think for me, what was so powerful about the book was twofold. I think one, for me, because it was the medium of a book where I'm reading, and so I, as the reader, as Kate Wong, I'm contextualizing what I'm reading in my own life. So I think I texted you when I was reading it, the part about, you know, one of my favorite scenes when you're talking about all these white, wealthy customers coming into the nail salon and you would just feel like so overawed by them and just, oh my gosh. And it reminded me of my childhood growing up where when we first came to the US, my mom, even though she had a bachelor's degree and was very successful in China, she couldn't work here because she didn't speak English. So she had to be a house cleaner. And she cleaned houses for people who at the time I thought were really wealthy. But now I look back, they're just, you know, upper middle class, including the family of one of my classmates from school. And so I would go into these homes, you know, where these kids would have so many toys. And I felt that same feeling, Susan. It was like reminding me of where I came from. So I think for me, the power of the book is that whoever reads it, depending on your own experiences, you could relate to that, one. And then the second thing is just learning more about how you are the way you are now through the sort of recounting of your childhood with all those details and truly being able to connect the dots from your mom, where she came from, her journey, and then who you are now. And I felt like it gave me a more complete appreciation of who you are. So that's my impression of the book. And so I actually felt the book was for me. Yeah, I loved your shows, but I felt like it was even more powerful for me. And I think that's what's so great, right? Is that people will respond to different things. And I really, that's why I love also the written medium where I can kind of digest and sit with it and relate to it myself, which then for me feels more powerful.
Yeah, like you can reread it again, or you can stop and you can let it absorb and then continue again. Whereas with a live show, it's just like bam, 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 bam. Right.
You're the one in control. Whereas for the book, you know, I'm the one in control of how I'm absorbing. I mean, it's your story, but like I'm doing the reading, right? And so I feel like that dynamic was very radical in terms of reading the book versus attending your shows. And
yeah, it's a changed power dynamic. I love that. Jeanette, what was it like for you? Just like initial thoughts of reading it. And then after that, I'm going to stop asking questions and then you guys can drive.
Oh, yeah. No, I felt like the book was very vivid for me. And I think like Kate, it's probably also colored by the fact that I know you personally. So there's that dimension of it where like most other books I read, I don't know the author. So there's not that context, but it gave me a really good feel for, hey, what was it like to be a six-year-old running around a nail salon where like all your, you know, relatives are working there every day of the week? What is it like to grow up with this mom who is a very incredible person, I would say, a very powerful person, a complicated person, but like, what was it like to be her youngest child? And also just like the food, right? Like sitting around the dining room table and your love for food and just honoring it, I think, with the level of detail and vividness, I think was awesome. And also ultimately, like, well, your mom's passing, how that's been a part of your life for so long, right? I mean, you talked about, I think even way before you even thought about doing a show or writing a book, you had this corner of your room just dedicated like a shrine to your mom, but then also all these things about her, photographs of her, and eventually things that happened with the botched surgery. It made me feel like I was there. And so I love that part. And I would have loved it even if I did not know you. But I think knowing you, like Kate said, it gave me a deeper understanding of you and how you are.
Keep me accountable, Jeanette. Always keep me accountable.
And of like the context for both the parts of you that I find wonderful and then the parts that I find more challenging. Like I understand, I think, oh, well, this is how Susan is because maybe it's just the way she's always been. Or it's also because of the family that she grew up in, right? And the context that she grew up in. So, yeah.
Yeah. There's so many ways you can read. I think I told you this, Susan, too, after I, by the way, I binged Susan's book on vacation. I basically needed it. I was like burned out by the kids. I told Nerva, I was like, just take the kids away. And I was just going to chill. But then I started reading your book and I was like, oh, I got to finish this. It's like, you know, when you read Harry Potter, like you just have to finish it in one go.
Yeah, it's a page turner. Yeah.
Yeah. I just was like, I got to finish this. I got to finish this. I got to finish this. And I just feel like people could read this in so many different ways. If you know Susan, you could read it and still learn so much. If you don't know Susan at all, you could read it and you just love it. And like the food part, can we talk about that? Oh my gosh. Like
talk about it.
I love food. We all love food. We come from families where food is so important. And your description of the food is just, I could taste it like in my mouth.
Oh my God.
Like I wanted to eat all of them. So I was curious though, did you set out write about food in this way? Or as you were writing, you know, because food is such a big part of your life and your family's interactions, it just kind of, you realize that, oh, so many things happen around food. Or did you say like, okay, I really want to bring out, you know, with intentionality?
Oh my God. I wish I had intentions and organization and plans. You know, I wrote this book proposal and there was chapter outline. If I should look at it again and look at what happened because it's probably really not the same. And never was I like, and then this will be like a food memoir. But I didn't realize, like, basically, my family is emotionally repressed. We don't talk about our feelings. The only time we ever do that is at the intersection of food, where you can express joy and warmth, and you can also express shame and dysfunction all around a dinner table. Now I can say that, oh yeah, food, family, and feelings. And that's why I did it this and that way. But in the heat of the moment while I'm writing, I would get so stuck and paralyzed. It was just post-it notes everywhere. Everybody just post-it notes where I was just like, I don't know, chicken wings. I definitely got to write about chicken wings, but I didn't know why. Or when we're in a scene and we're in a moment with the family, of course there's food there. It is so part of my family. And sometimes I think about, like, why are we so obsessed about food? I never actually thought we were that obsessed about food until I hung out with other families. And I was like, this is what we're eating. They like microwave, like steam some broccoli in the microwave and then eat it over pasta, but by themselves, like a kid would eat it by themselves at a table and the family wasn't there. I was like, oh my God, wait, this is really different.
I had a question about that, though. I would think that I was curious about. It seemed like when your grandparents moved in, right? And then you had your aunts there and then there was like this long table and you guys would spread out the newspapers and your grandma would just bring out plate after plate and people would eat. But before your grandparents moved in and it was just your parents and your siblings, was it still like that? Was your mom and dad, were they big cooks or were they really busy running the salon? Because I think there were like also some references to KFC and stuff like that. So did that really change after your grandparents moved in or?
Yeah, I mean, because I'm like my grandparents moved in when I was like 8 years old. So I'm trying to like to actually lock it down on that time of memory. But yeah, there was KFC, there was Little Caesar's Pizza. I mean, we would have some Vietnamese food, but it's like my dad was running his gardening business. My mom was starting up her nail salon business. There was not a lot of time. But on the weekends, maybe we would have a party and have some Vietnamese food. But yeah, no, definitely once grandma came in, it was always a soup, a protein, and a vegetable, right? Yeah. It was always a full, complete meal, and we always gathered. And I don't think it was possible to talk about food without family.
Yeah.
Or sorry, family without food.
Maybe both. But the other thing that I was also thinking about, and it kind of relates even beyond the book, how it's like basically from the time you were 8 to the time you were 11 or 12, right? When after your mom passes, a lot of your extended families move out and the dynamic really changed, right? But for those 3 or 4 years is this time when you have all these memories of a big bustling household, delicious food, and it's just busy. I think the book also made me think about my experience as I think is pretty natural. But like how I also have these maybe relatively short, but like times in my childhood that felt very formative to me, right? That had an outsized impact and maybe also were the happy times. Yeah. The times that even though like, I think in a lot of ways, all of our childhoods had really difficult times, but there were these pockets that felt really good in important ways and how that maybe helped us. Sorry, I'm veering a little bit off the book, but maybe we can explore it in a different episode. But sometimes I wonder like why I turned out the way that I did. If you look at just the demographics of how I grew up, how you grew up, Susan, I think to some extent, Kate, you as well, you know, growing up in a family that was poor, that had a lot of conflict, in my case, domestic violence, you know, parents who did not attend higher education. Now that I'm older and I read more, it's not like I'm purposely seeking out this information, but when it comes across my desk, I'm like, wow, I'm really kind of an anomaly. And I wonder why that is. And so the way it relates back to what I was just saying before is that I wonder if those pockets of, they're like life rafts, right? Things we can hold on to, things that make us feel like that where we feel loved and belonging and you know, a sense of connection with family, that they stay with us in a very powerful way.
Yeah.
Kate, for you, that might have been like summers in China, you know, where you felt like you had talked about on the podcast before, like feeling very free and connected with your extended family. So I don't know if that resonates with you, Susan, like this kind of time period when you had all these family members around.
Yeah, it was good times. And some of the stories like the Sizzler chapter, when my family finally makes $1,000 at the nail salon, and we get to go to Sizzler for the first time. I mean, that was such a high point in my childhood, or just feeling like we were in war and all the family members worked at the nail salon and we would combat it. We were like a battalion. We were all functioning together and making something possible. Like we all had purpose and we were all working together, and it was a really beautiful time. Yeah.
Speaking of family, I'm dying to know, as we've talked about on the podcast and you mentioned in the show, various members of your family, they've had different disapproving or uncomprehending reactions to your quest to rediscover your mom, why she died, how she died, and your shows. And were you worried about how they would respond to the memoir? And then what's the actual response? Have they read it? Because I think Jeanette, in one of her questions, I don't know, Asians are always very, don't want anybody else to know about our dirty business. This is our, you know, own thing. Not dirty business, maybe not the right word.
Dirty laundry secrets, yeah.
Don't air dirty laundry. That's like one of the top commandments of Asian elders.
Saving face, yeah.
Yeah. So like, yeah, tell us.
Yeah. By the time I wrote the book, my sister and my oldest brother, Kang, are on board. They've come to several post-show talkbacks after the show in San Francisco and Seattle. They are cool with it. We don't actively talk about it, but they're cool with it. And I remember I had an earlier version after my editor was like, green light, okay, this is ready to go. And I was like, oh my God, no. I was like, give the book back to me. Give it back to me for another month so I can look at it again. But it was when I got the book back. So this was February 2023. I gave the copy to my sister because I knew this is pretty much done. And I said, can you have a read? And I remember just even asking her to read it and mentioning on the phone, would she be open to reading it? I had to like prepare myself for this call and figure out when the perfect time was to ask her. It was not chill by any means. And I tell her about it. She goes, okay, I'm open. When I hit send, I'm falling out of my chair right now. My stomach was churning the whole time thinking, oh my God, I'm like rocking back and forth thinking like, oh, I was just so scared. As her as an early reader, because she is a bridge to the rest of my family. And it was really interesting because then she reads it and she goes, okay, I have two changes. And I was like, okay, what are they? And then I heard them and I'm like, fine. It was just like, remove this one word, remove this one name, and we're good. And I was like, okay, anything else? She's like, no. And I was like, so what'd you think? She's like, it's kind of like a long journal entry. It's pretty accurate. And I was like, okay. And she's like, okay. I was like, the thing that I worked on for 2 years. And when you think about all the drafts of my plays and then the book proposal, and this is over, I think I calculated like over 38 drafts. It read like a journal entry. Maybe that's good. Maybe it just flows. I'm like, fine. So that was a relief because then I was like, great, I'm good. And then I moved forward with the copy editing and then putting the book into process for print. I gave a copy to my aunt when she came to visit me. But at this point, it has not yet gone to the printer. She don't really read that much English. Maybe she's not going to read it. But I gave it to her, right? Me and the publisher were like, okay, no more changes. We're going to the printer. I gave it to my two brothers because I could not deal. Like, I don't even know if they read, to be honest.
I mean, they read, but like, you don't know if they read like a lot of books.
Yeah, no, they don't. They don't read a lot of books.
Just wanted to clarify that. Like,
we don't read words. No, I needed to know that I could not make any changes. As you read in the book, like I'm the youngest of four. I always listen to them. Besides the whole like finding the truth of my mother part. In general, I take orders and I couldn't have them tell me to change it. Does my dad have a copy? No, he does not. I am waiting for the hardcover and that will come out sometime in February where it's like a finished book where the cover is embossed or there's color pictures inside. I'll give him the final product. I don't know. Maybe I should send him the current one. But the thing is, my dad and I still currently do not talk about the book. We pretend it does not exist. Also, the second oldest brother, we do not actually talk about the book. We just had Christmas and I showed them a flyer of my book and telling them I'm coming to the Bay Area for the tour. And it was as if I said, hey, are there any carrots in the fridge? That was the response. It was just like, okay, that was it, guys. It's still this very strange thing where I'm just like, am I the crazy one? You know, because I'm just, yup, it's going to be out there. Like, do we want to talk about it or whatever? And everyone's just like, but everyone's showing up in different ways. So my sister and I are talking about doing a collaboration chocolate box with Socola, our chocolate company, where we're going to have images from the book in there. Cool. My brother was like, hey, when you come to Santa Rosa, I'll throw you a party. And I was like, okay, that's cool. I'm going to weave it into some other things that I'm doing with the book to make sure I get the book distributed to low-income folks. And then the other brother who was like, why is anyone going to want to support you anyways? What's in it for them? And I was like, ouch. Even though he did not really talk about the book, what he did do was bring an unknown photo album to Christmas. And it was with photos I have never seen before.
Yeah.
So that was beautiful. You know what I mean? Like, it's not, oh, it's still not Full House where they like acknowledge your dreams.
I mean, that's like its own thing, right? We could probably spend a lot of time doing armchair psychologist about why it is that your family, but also a lot of families in general, Asian families in particular, why it's so hard to talk about things like this. Like, why? Like, why? Actually, there was one thing that this conversation made me think about from your book, which is after your mother passed, how your aunts are moving out. And then there's some conflict between your aunts, your mother's sisters, and your father. To me, at least reading it, it seemed like there was a lot of miscommunication between them and just your family in general about why people thought other people were upset and what they might be upset about. It seemed like there was a lot of conflict, but not a lot of clear communication about what the actual issues were, which I feel is very common. Maybe it's just a fear of like open conflict. And so people would rather just like skirt around it.
Oh my God.
Even if that means there's a lot of misunderstanding and not a clear way to like maybe make things better or just express your feelings.
I think open conflict is so much better than hidden conflict. Hidden conflict is where it's scary because we can just build up so many stories about other people and just so many battles can continually be fought. It's terrible. It's awful. It destroyed our family.
But at the same time, it seems there's like interest and some supportiveness there, but like it's very mixed.
Yeah. Well, one good thing is my aunt is hawking these books from her nail salon in Northern California. She's always telling me how many books she sold. And I'm like, great.
Oh, that's awesome.
I don't know. Like part of it, too, is I think maybe I'm going to speak for her, but it's called the manicurist daughter. You know, like it's shedding a light in this faceless industry where they serve people. And now you get to see this complex world and that these folks are courageous and kind and complicated and flawed. And I hope that this will be like a source of pride in the Vietnamese community and in the nail salon community.
Yeah, I think that there's definitely the socioeconomic lens, which I think you and Kate were discussing earlier, because you've had a lot of different vantage points, right? And I kind of think about this for myself as well, coming from a place where your parents are boat people, then your parents are working in this lower wage service industry, and you also working in the family business. And then 30 years later, you're well-educated, you're kind of swimming in different circles. And so you have the language to maybe speak about it to a wider audience, but then still you live that experience of what is it like to be a child in a low-income household, in a refugee immigrant household, and being able to give voice to that experience. So I think that that's also a huge contribution.
Yeah. I mean, going back to you saying the word anomaly of like, how do we get here? I want Marvin to calculate the math and the probability of how I got here. Because my mom didn't finish ninth grade in rural Mekong Delta, southern Vietnam. So like she won the lottery 3 times, guys, based on this game that has 6 slots in numbers, okay? She wins it 3 times. They try to escape Vietnam 5 times and make it out on the 6th time. Every time someone leaves, they know they have a 50% chance of survival. We get to America and my mom is the person who can open the nail salon instead of just work at the nail salon. And has 2. And then somehow I get into Harvard. When you think about all of that probability, it's pretty insane.
Yeah.
It's crazy. It's crazy. If I never watched Legally Blonde that day on the couch, would have never happened.
Listeners, go back to previous episode to hear another crazy Susan story.
But yeah, got to Harvard. And then the probability of me getting a top 5 publisher book deal to then actually tell our story.
Yeah.
It's just insane.
I don't want to put these words in your mouth, Susan, but I wonder if just everything that you said and that you're able to share your story with everybody, and I, you know, it's touched me and Jeanette. And I think once people read it, I think a lot of people will be impacted by your work as they have already been if they've seen your show, right? I feel like that there's this sort of tension in that by sharing your story and your family's story and everything that they've been through, you'll have touched a lot of people's lives. And yet in some way, you're in your own family. Most people still don't want to talk about it. It's
weird, right? Because I think even if we objectively know it's fine, a family may never approve of this,
but you still want it. Isn't there a part of you, Susan? I don't want to put words in your mouth. Isn't there a part of you that still wants, that craves that approval from your family? Yeah, Susan, you just think this is so awesome that you published a book. Do you want that from them?
Yeah. I mean, I can still want that. What I really want is an intimate relationship with my family where they see me the way I want to be seen. Okay. That's probably nearly impossible. I don't think they have probably the interest nor the capacity to do that. Okay. So I've had to do a lot of my own self-work around that I can still feel whole and love myself and honor myself without them never giving me that. And I think college Susan, pre-mom Susan was like devastated, utterly devastated. That could never happen for her, where I was just like clawing and clawing and being like, please, please, please. And they were just like, don't want any of it. But I think I've gone through this grief curve with my mother's death. The first line of the book, everyone knows the tragedy of the dead, but let's talk about the tragedy of the living. Okay. So I've gone through my own grief curve, not just with my mother's death, but with this loss that I feel within my own family, that why can't it be this way? Why is it so hard? And so there's denial and there's anger and there's sadness. And there's the mourning of it. And then the point where we all want to get to is, how do we transform a painful thing into something that we find meaning from, that uplifts us? And so that's where I'm at now. And I'm not angry at anybody in my family. I used to be angry. And there's a lot about me and my dad in there. I used to be really angry. And now I don't have the anger anymore. You know, I have the compassion more, but it's more because I've done so much examining about their journey that they can't tell me. And when I kind of really sat with that journey and I could see that, I realized, whoa, it is about me and also completely not about me. I think it's very hard for me not to take anything personally. And so that's been the struggle for decades. But now I'm in a place where I'm not wanting that. I don't need that from them. And I think it's because of the shows where folks would come up to me afterwards and tell me, hey, like what it meant for them, or tell me their stories. I felt like this lightness, this energy, this love, it just made me feel like I was living for a higher purpose, and that energy was life-giving instead of life-taking. And for so long, when I was pining with my family, it was life-taking. And so now I'm just choosing, okay, maybe it's not going to ever be full house with my family where we talk to each other and interact with each other in a certain way, but I don't need that to make me feel whole anymore, because I know I have this bigger purpose. And that also, when I continue to stay small in our secrets and to hide from it and to not process it, that was my own death. And it was when I was able to do my own journey in, I guess, a very public way, it was healing for me. And I wish that for them. And I also realized it's not fully about me. I used to make it about me. And now that I cannot make it about me, I feel more lightness in my life. I feel more capacity to hold them when they're feeling frustrated. And also, honestly, it's like magnets. Because I'm not pushing up against them with my anger anymore, I feel less anger from them. So there has been a shift. As much as I wish I could control them and I wish they would be a certain way, when I've fundamentally changed for myself, truly, like not in a bullshit way, but like in a true way where I freed myself from it, from that wanting, that craving, I actually freed them from our perpetual tension. Not saying it's not hard, but it's way less hard than it's ever been. And I'm really happy about that. And I think motherhood actually helped me a little bit with that.
Yeah. Yeah, so many directions. I'm curious, just to go back to a little bit of the earlier strand of the conversation about sharing stories that are yours, but also other people's. I think about that also on the podcast, and what makes it okay for me to share a story that is mine because it's part of my life, but also other people's, and they may not want me to share it. Did you struggle at all writing this book about, oh, it is my story, but maybe I should just write this for myself, right? I spent 2 years writing this for yourself, you know, versus doing it public, because on the podcast, I share a lot of stories about my parents and what it was like growing up with them. Some things are good. A lot of it is pretty hard, and I would say does not make them look too good. So it's something that I also have thought about, and I think I've come to certain conclusions or principles, but would love to hear if that's something you struggled with while you were putting this together and for your show too.
Of like the scope of what I would tell, you mean?
Yeah.
Or just telling other people's stories?
Yeah, both.
I think when I was writing, it was like so hard. Like just getting any word down or coherent sentences was just really hard, because I already had the show. I already had the text of the show, the script, but the medium of pages is different than the medium of stage, right? And so I had to go really deep, and I would get really blocked, and I hit a lot of walls. And so my solution was to get high. No one's ever surprised, because there are so many traumatic memories. It is very painful. Or like, can I remember what the nail salon door, how it opened and closed? It was very emotionally painful for me to go back and remember and to just push stuff out. So in the beginning, I wasn't even trying to be choosy, thinking about these wonderful questions that are so intentional. I was literally just trying to get words out. And from there, it culled the wheat, try to figure out what is useful for a while, for a whole year, I didn't even know what the through line of the book was. Like, it was just the struggle bus. Like, I would say, like, a year into the book that maybe I could kind of curate and refine a little bit more. But it's the last half, 6 months, where I was just actually, like, craft, 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 okay? And then that's where I can make more decisions. I struggled a bit because there's one family character that I have excluded from the book at the request of my father. And this is when I don't like it when people tell me what to do, because then I must preserve the truth of it all, but it must intersect with this through line. But if my dad says he will not talk to me ever again, if I do that one thing, I have to consider it. So at first I was like, okay, that's interesting feedback. But I was like, but let me write the story I need to write for myself. So I started with that. And so I wrote her as a character in the book. And I wrote just a piece. Nothing's ever a chapter. It's just like thoughts, okay? Like, honestly, I wish I was the person who had outlines. I'm not. And I started writing her in. And I would work with my, I had a book doctor. So book doctor is not a ghostwriter. She didn't write the book. She is someone who's like a therapist, like an emotional therapist, and also has skills as an editor to say, oh, this is gold. I have follow-up questions here. Or when it came to fine editing, she would claw at Wolverine and kill stuff, right? But when she was reading, she was like, wow, this one person you're very attached to that you're not allowed to write about is actually not that important of a character compared to all these other characters. And my family's so big, I have so many other characters. So do you need to do that? Is it worth it? Because she's actually not adding that much. So that was struggle number one of like, should I include or exclude? There are a lot of stories I excluded. Well, some that I was attached to that just got cut because it was like, what's the purpose of it? It's a cool story, but what's the purpose? Not the through line. Fine, that hurt me. That was like my babies, like my darlings. I love them. There's other like amazing stories, but maybe it'll come through somewhere else. Fine, we cut those. But there's other scandalous secrets that I didn't mention because it's not going to truly serve the through line. Do I already have enough evidence to paint the character, the family members in a three-dimensional way that's true and honest? Must I include this other salacious thing lest it truly damage my real in-life relationship with them? Not worth it. So those things I excluded. While I'm writing, I would consider, and then I'm like, no, that's not worth it. At the end of the day, this is not a documentary. I'm not a historian. I'm a storyteller. And so part of it is keeping it focused and tight and fast. Like, how does it remain a page turner? Must I state every single thing if what I already said already proves to you or indicates to you what this type of character is that is also true and honest and three-dimensional? So that's kind of like the complicated stuff that I had to work with. There was a couple of names that I changed to protect their privacy, including the plastic surgeon's kids' names. But for the most part, all the other names are accurate and correct. Oh, and also changed the cult people's names because we don't want a lawsuit. There's some of that, Jeanette. Am I fully answering your question?
You're kind of getting to it. You know, you had this thing to work out with just knowing who your mom was, what happened to her, and then your family's totally stonewalling you. And so you needed a way to figure that out. You did it in a way that's art and it's public. And so did you struggle with that at all, right? Because I think that's a question that I've also asked myself on the podcast. What do I say?
Yeah.
Something that is part of my experience, but also part of somebody else's experience. And also they might not want that out there, right? It's kind of like the give and take of the relationships that we're in with friends and family. By being in relationship, we know certain things about each other. We have certain shared experiences, but then it becomes information to both parties, right?
Yeah. There was a line that my brother said in person that I put in the show, that I put in the book, which said, Susan, you're exploiting our family story. Okay. And so he said that to me. Maybe I was doing like the first few shows. The fifth one is 140 pounds. So maybe the third or fourth show. And he mentioned that to me and I was like, oh shit, am I? And actually, I remember I asked the spirit channeler, the psychic, Cindy the psychic.
Oh, you write about it in the book.
Right. I asked essentially my mom, am I? Because I'm not here to be like, hey, I want you to hate this sibling and that sibling or whatever. They're not good people. I'm not trying to make the world darker here. I'm trying to make the world lighter. Like, that's the purpose of my work. And so actually, I did seek the permission of my mother through the psychic. And she said, no, that's not what you're doing. Okay, like you're trying to bring healing to the world. I don't know if I really would have fully written this memoir if my brother and sister weren't on board, the other brother, if they never had the turn with the play. Because it could have been like the play happens, they don't show up to the post-show talk back, and then they like take legal action or something. You know, like it could have gone like really bad.
Yeah.
And then I would have been like, yeah, I should stop. You know, like other memoirists, some memoirists are not in touch with their family anymore because of maybe the cult situation or whatever. Their cult situation, not mine. Separate one. And it breaks families apart. And so in this way, I was kind of like bringing my family along who were open to coming along. And it was really great that I did get my sister's blessing with her read. I don't know. It's weird. It's like I don't have like very direct approval. It seems like this light permissioning. My dad said that if I had done my play, performed my show in Houston, he would have stopped talking to me. And it's not like we talk a lot anyways, but that put the brakes on it. And then I was like, okay, maybe I shouldn't. Okay, fine. I won't go. I think I've been taking kind of measured steps along the way. My experience is still my story. And I write all this with an intent of love for them. And I hope that comes through in the ending. I never wanted this. Sure, I wanted to write Roots. I wanted that. I wanted this idea of knowing where I came from. But all I ever wanted was to know my mother. All I ever wanted to know is, are you guys okay? And unfortunately, they don't have the capacity to tell me that. And so this is the journey I had to go on to do it. Maybe it would have been really different if we went to grief counseling, you know, and if we were able to talk about it and we were able to check in. I got to admit, my family is a strong unit. Like, we had this thing called extreme indulgence. We spent a 5-day sleepover together during Christmas every year with all my siblings. By the way, me and Marvin won the food cooking competition.
Congratulations. Yes.
Oh my God. After I was done cooking, and you'll read about it in the book, everybody, extreme indulgence. After I was done cooking, we cooked from Rintaro, Japanese cookbook. I sat down because it was like a 6-course meal. I sat down and my sister-in-law was like, go get the wine. And I was like, I can't move my legs. I literally can't move my legs right now. Like, I was so exhausted. But anyways, the point is, it's a strange thing when I feel so alone in my family and yet we hang out so much. Like, we actually choose to spend time together a lot during the holidays and a lot of weekends when I am back in California. So I have a healthy, dysfunctional relationship where it's very positive. We're just not vulnerable. And that's what breaks me, where the yearning is. Maybe this all would have been different if they just answered my question the first time or the 8th time or the 20th time, but they didn't. And so this is where I had to go, you know, which kind of sucks for them. But they look good in the end.
Oh, yeah. I think I'm coming at it with a hybrid Asian and Western lens, right? Which is, I feel like you paint your family members with a lot of love and compassion. And in a very 3-dimensional way, I also feel like, of course, it's tragic what happened to your mother. I don't see it as particularly shameful or anything like that. To me, you're complicated, but like also a strong love for your family members really comes through in the book. And I hope they also see it that way. I think one question I've been turning over in my mind is, what is that kind of like shame, right? Where does it like really come from? Because I feel like a lot of times when you just look at it in the face, it's not actually that big of a thing. I think actually in American culture too, and to some lesser extent, but we tend to see people more as individuals and not like someone in their family does something and then the whole family is blacklisted. But I think there is a little bit of that effect in American culture. But in Asian culture, that is really big, right? That question has been turning over in my mind, like, how does that actually play out? Anyway, I hope that your family members can see that you present them with a lot of love and compassion in a nuanced way.
Yeah, I agree. I don't feel that I came out of the book feeling really angry on your behalf against any member of the family. I felt that they were very human. And I could see a lot of those emotions in some of my family members. So I think you painted them lovingly, right? And love isn't just always only saying the good things. It's also being honest, but in a fair way, right? And I think that's how people come across in the book. I would agree with Jeanette on that. If any of your family members ever listen to this podcast or anything, I think
I don't think they do.
Yeah. Okay. But on the off chance that they do, you know,
they didn't even take a flyer.
You never know. Never say never, Susan. Maybe my mom has downloaded Apple Podcasts and they listen to our podcast. I don't know. No, I hope not. I think, you know, curious though, Susan, you've done a lot even during COVID and having through changing your career and doing this book. So you've processed a lot. What's next for you? What's next for you in terms of, I guess, where you want to take your story? I mean, you don't have to give dastardly plans or like secret, you know, whatever. You don't tell us those, but
yeah. Well, yeah. Well, I got to tell you some short-term things and then I'll tell you the long-term. Short-term is I'm planning for my 10-city national tour, which I need to be like, no, it's just 5 cities, just so I don't create another health problem for myself of bigger, better, you know, create all the stress. But it'll probably be a 10-city national tour. I'm forming Susan's ride or die street team right now of people who want to promote the tour and invite people to the cities I'm coming to, which is great. So that's a thing.
And so it'll be a book tour, right? So you'll be visiting bookstores and doing readings, et cetera, right?
Well, you think I'd just go to a bookstore and make life easy. But what if it was in different types of interesting locations? So, I mean, there will be like community centers and like really cool hip bars. Maybe be in the Garden Center Mall, like a mall in Orange County that is like the center for Vietnamese Americans and stuff. Some other surprises along the way. So book tour. And is it a book talk? Do you think we're just going to have a standard book talk? No, hopefully it's going to be beyond expectation in terms of an emotional roller coaster and a transformative experience for all that come.
I know. I just can't. I just. I think people are going to come. Like, they're going to expect like nice, calm 45 minutes where, you know, you like read a section of the book, people politely clap and then have some Q&A. But then like all of a sudden there's strobe lights and you're coming in like a sequin tux.
I do have this cool costume, but
no. Avocado costume.
Oh, I've done that too many times. My mangosteen outfit, it's been done. But no, I mean, I really want it to be representative of the book and the experience of emotions. And my big theme in the book, a recurring line, and what I want for the tour is when we feel, we heal. You know, when we are confronting our big F word of feelings, of the things that we avoid because we don't want to be in pain, when we can go through that and face it, I think that there's something better for us out there. And so I hope I can do that in a meaty way in 1 hour at a book talk as a small experience for my audience members. I'm also trying to play Robin Hood with my book. So I have a project called the Community Book Exchange, where folks can buy books, they're tax-deductible donations, and then I'm going to redistribute them to community-based organizations that serve refugees and immigrants. So that's one initiative that I'm building right now. And then I'm going to go on tour and have a lot of fun, and hopefully it'll be a party in every city, and please say hi to me, and please pre-order the book.
Yeah, we should say the book is available for pre-ordering now on Amazon,
yes.
And it's coming out on
March 12th.
March 12th.
3, 12, 24. All the multiples divide into each other. Not just Amazon, but indie bookstores, Barnes & Noble, Bookshop, Books A Million. There's so many ways to access the book. And pre-orders are super important because they give me a very strong chance to get on a bestseller list and like the New York Times. And if I can get 5,000 pre-orders, that gives me actually an 80% chance of getting on it. And if I'm on those lists, I'm able to be discovered by other book clubs or by other journalists and other speaking gigs and all this stuff to just amplify the message around intergenerational trauma and healing through humor, right? So like for me as a marginalized emerging writer to make it and for the publishing industry to say we should keep greenlighting more AAPI stories, mine should do well. They need proof of concepts of, oh, that did well. Let's keep buying more of these. So part of this is if you want to read for your inner child, do it. If you want to help repair intergenerational trauma in your family, do it. If you want to share this with the community for our own collective healing, do that. If you want more marginalized stories out there, do it for that. And to pre-order is really big because my first week number is all the pre-orders plus that first week of sales is my number. And if I can hit 5,000, it will be pretty life-changing for me. So I really sincerely ask any listener that is remotely interested to do it.
Or buy not just one copy, but 5 or 10.
Five.
Give it to friends.
Yeah. And also be part of the Community Book Exchange too.
Yeah.
Susan, if there's a way that any of our listeners, they want to, you know, help you out with your book tour or, you know, the nonprofit donation aspect, how can they reach you?
Just go to my website, SusanLiu.me. It'll have all the information on there. Like I read every email that I get there. If you have ideas like, oh my God, like my city's not on your tour list. Like I want you to come and I'm going to help find organizations to host you. I'm like, cool, let's do it. Let's play. It's a pretty organic grassroots movement. Even though I'm with a top 5 publisher, I am actually on the hook for organizing my whole tour. So any help is much appreciated. Okay, so that's short-term stuff. Long-term. All right, guys, you know I wanted to always be a performer and entertainer. We're looking for a film TV co-agent, which means to shop around my book to sell the rights. And I want to be creatively attached to it as a writer and possibly audition to play myself. So, yeah, you know, I've gotten so much feedback. They're like, nobody knows you. You're not an A-lister. The project's already going to tank. And I'm like, Okay. All right. Thanks for your feedback. You know, it's probably right. It's probably all true. But, you know, I think I have a good shot to audition for myself. So I am going to hopefully, you know, I'd like to be creatively attached to write for it and it to be an episodic TV series or a movie. So I'd like to continue to think about mass market. How do we have this experience of working through our stuff, of being on this healing journey in a way that's mass market and available to more people? So that I don't have to perform it live every night. You can read about it. You can read the story and feel that experience. You can watch it and binge it. Great. So I'd love to do that. I would like to be a motivational speaker still. And I'm signing up. Macmillan asked me to be on their speakers bureau. So universities and corporations can come hire me. And hopefully I'll make you cry in your cubicle. And I was actually recently on a second episode of Look, Listen, and Learn, a kids TV show. Which was super fun. And I wonder if I should be accountable to you, but I should write a pilot for my kids' TV show. You know, be ready when all this happens, because I really think who our children are looking at and what they look like matters. And I also just applied for this grant to put on my third big production. If I get it, you might one day come see me back in the theater for my next show, which would be called Not 140 Pounds, Not Over 140 Pounds, but 8 pounds, 8 ounces.
And that going to be about motherhood, I'm guessing?
Yeah, the absurdity of motherhood. Oh, also, I was like, I don't know. I've just been writing some stuff around postpartum motherhood stuff. I was just at a writer's retreat. I wrote like 17,000 words in a few days, which was like crazy. So I don't know. Maybe I'll work on another book and maybe there's a second memoir around postpartum stuff. But guys, it's seriously a lot of ifs. I've been like sitting in a lot of uncertainty. I'm trying to like not drink right now, eat really healthy, exercise a lot because I feel so anxious about the uncertainty of the future slash there's just so many tasks to do with all these things I'm telling you about. So I'm trying to also learn how to sit in the not knowing, because I have been talking to Marvin. I'm like, oh my God, okay, 3 months from now, you know, after the tour's over, what do I do with my life? And I don't really know right now. And it's kind of freaking me out.
Yeah, I don't want to freak you out even more, but...
But do, please.
But I mean, it was one of the questions that I had for you, which is this thing happened when you were 11. It's been like this thing in your life, right, since then. And not that it's gone away, it hasn't, but this has been a big milestone, right, in terms of coming to terms with it. And then once the book is out, and then there will be all the activity around it, and then it's like, where does your creative energy go next, right? And I think it's pretty clear from knowing you and from reading the book, even confirming that it's like even before anything happened with your mom, that's like a part of who you are, like performance, being an artist. And so I'm sure, I'm confident that you will find a way to express that. And that's not going to just go away with the publishing of this book. But I think it is like a little bit, like you said, there's some unknowns, like where will that be channeled next? I think whatever it is, it'll be good. It may not be like necessarily linear, but I'm sure that.
What I would give to be linear.
Kate, do you have any other last questions or?
I just tell everybody to read the book. Buy the damn book.
Okay. Inside thought, your favorite scene in the book.
There's so many. I'll just mention a couple. First, the scene with your mom one time when she was trying to make the escape and they were raided by the police or something. And she took your two brothers and was just like running through the jungle barefoot and how they almost died out there. And then they made it back and her sister was pulling these thorns out of her feet. Just the craziness of that. The craziness of their circumstance, but also your mom's determination, I thought was really memorable and made a big impression. Another one was with the clam digging scene when you guys go out at night and are digging those clams, but then you go back later and there's like a sign that says, don't dig clams there. Also risk of contamination, possibly. I think that was also something I could kind of relate to because growing up in California, like I remember going to Pismo Beach with my parents and digging for clams. And I remember when we would leave the parking lot, you had to go through these park ranger stations and you had to like reveal how many clams you had. But sometimes my parents would have this secret ice box in the trunk that they would not disclose because the clams in there, the size wouldn't be like regulatory. They weren't big enough or something. So just that whole experience of partaking in the bounty of the United States. But I almost feel like I shouldn't say this, but you know, sometimes not necessarily adhering to all the rules.
You can always write new policies.
also, this is not like one particular scene, but I'll add one last one for good measure. I mean, one big theme of your show was your relationship to your body and food, right? But one of the things was your mom telling you that you needed to finish your food, even though you were telling her that you're so full and you force feed yourself. And then you just vomited all out at this restaurant, and how embarrassed you were, how your mother reacted. And so I feel like this is where kind of the nuance of how you paint your mom kind of comes. She was this incredible person. I mean, I think she was incredible. She was obviously this very forceful, entrepreneurial, determined personality, right? And she was the matriarch, even though she was not the oldest girl among her 9 or 10 siblings. But she was also complicated. She'd do these things that I think kind of hurt you. And so, you know, and having experiences like that around food, but paired with also really delicious food prepared with love, kind of gave you like this mixed feeling about what is my relationship with food, right? It's a little bit confusing. And so, yeah, there was so many memorable scenes, but I'll just pause there.
Oh, I love that. How about you, Kate?
I think I mentioned one scene already early on, which was, you know, all those wealthy customers in your salon, but a couple more excerpts that I really like. One, the scene where your mom buys you these chicken wings and it's just you and her driving home. And you keep thinking, okay, I'm going to save half for Wendy, your older sister, because you're always used to sharing everything with her, right? And then you're like, maybe I'll eat one more. Maybe when Wendy won't notice if there's just, you know, two seems like a good amount to, you know, for her to get. And then your mom notices that, probably, you know, saving this for your sister, and she gives you the permission to just eat them all and she won't say anything. Yeah. And I think to echo what Jeanette said earlier, there are a lot of, your mom is such a complex person, right? And I felt like that really reflected a lot about both you and your dynamic as, you know, having a sister, which made me think of my girls, but then also your mother, and that she was sensitive to that in you. And then the other scene, which I think you might have mentioned in the podcast or like one of your shows, that was when you got really mad at your aunt for basically calling me fat. You basically told her, you like grabbed her belly fat and was like, don't you ever do that to me again. My mom died because she had tummy, had the surgery. And it was like, girl, I wish I could do something like that, you know? And the thing is, she took it and she was like, okay. It was like, not just what you did, but also her reaction, which meant that she knew. She didn't say, I'm sorry, right? I don't think you ever said, sorry. But that was her, I'm sorry. That was a reminder that for us, I think our generation growing up in the US, we really want to hear, I'm sorry. But for many of our elders, they're never going to say those words. But what they do means I'm sorry. And I think we have to accept that. Otherwise, like you said earlier, Susan, we just won't ever move on, right? There has to be some sort of like a reckoning in the middle. So yeah, those two things.
Ladies, thank you so much for taking the time to read. But most importantly, for being with me on this journey, like when I was on writer's retreats and with deadlines and with just all of it. And like recording this podcast has been part of the sanity of not writing and just like connecting. And thank you for helping me get to here.
Oh, it's been lovely and a privilege, honestly, to just be able to be with you while you're going through this. And like I said, super proud of you. And I'm so excited when the book goes out.
I can't wait for you to come to book talk.
We'll dress up in costume for you.
Okay. Yeah. Can you make signs for me? I'm asking everyone to make signs because it'd be fun.
Okay. I will make signs just this one time.
All right. And that's it for Model Minority Moms.
We hope you found something helpful, reassuring, or interesting in this episode of Model Minority Moms. If you enjoyed the episode, please help us spread the word by texting a friend about our show or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. If you want to connect with us, please visit our website at modelminoritymoms.com or follow us on Instagram, where we love receiving messages from our listeners.